The Rolling Stones hit the road again in April, the band's first North American tour since 2015. The first show is April 20th in Miami. They'll wrap up the tour in Chicago on June 21st. This year marks the 50th anniversary of a notorious Stones tour. They trekked across America in the fall of 1969. That 69 tour ended on a chilly December night in Altamont in Northern California. The free music festival, with scores of other bands, including the Grateful Dead, Jefferson Airplane, and Santana, quickly descended into chaos. A young concertgoer was stabbed to death in front of the stage as the Stones played. Some have long pointed to Altamont as a symbolic end of 1960s idealism. Joel Selvin tells the story in Altamont, the Rolling Stones, the Hell's Angels, and the inside story of rock's darkest day. We spoke in 2016.
Joel, set the scene for us. The Stones in 69, you know, were huge. They had a new guitarist in Mick Taylor. The band was really intrigued by the Summer of Love psychedelia of the San Francisco sound. It's almost as if Mick Jagger wanted his own sort of version of Woodstock on the West Coast. Is that correct?
I think so. I think the Stones originally scheduled that tour out of sort of a financial emergency. They were broke and they couldn't get the money that they were owed out of their manager. And when they arrived here, they discovered the rock scene was quite significantly different than the 3 years before when they last played in the United States. And I think they were quite surprised by how famous, how enormous the whole rock scene had come and what their position was. And over the course of the tour, as they began to discover this, they began to see a vision of a bigger, brighter future. And the last dates in New York were filmed for a movie that hadn't been planned until the day before. But they didn't have an end to the movie. They just had the New York. The free concert had been in the works. It was an idea that had been promoted to Keith Richards by the Grateful Dead manager, Rock Scully, and I think in a somewhat sort of whimsical fashion. But it had been taken seriously in the Stones camp, and Rock, he picked it up and ran with it. And at that point, I think that the vision of this free concert in this Woodstock-esque setting was just too seductive as an ending to this movie.
So the Stones were just beginning to understand the depth of their own fame and popularity. And you make clear that one of the Grateful Dead's managers, Rock Scully, was really behind the idea to let the Hell's Angels provide security for the free concert. But the Stones went along with it. It proved to be a fatal mistake.
The Hell's Angels were well known to the Grateful Dead. One of the Hell's Angels, for instance, was the LSD distributor for Owsley, the manufacturer of all the Grateful Dead's LSD and their audio expert. The original plans called for the concert to be held in Golden Gate Park, which would put the San Francisco chapter of Hell's Angels squarely in charge. When it moved out of San Francisco, after the Rolling Stones tried to get permits out of the mayor's office, Rock Scully never expected to do it that way. His plan was to have a Grateful Dead and Jefferson Airplane concert and bring the Stones in as a surprise special guest. But when it moved out of San Francisco, then there was no jurisdiction for the Hell's Angels, and it was a free-for-all. Don't think that that kind of subtle politics of the Hell's Angels, that was totally lost on the Rolling Stones, who had no idea who the California Hell's Angels were. They'd had a free concert in Hyde Park, and British Hell's Angels had attended and been given some role backstage. But these guys had clean leather jackets. They drew their colors on with chalk, and they rode mopeds. They were not
the Hell's Angels, right? And the first thing that happens to Mick Jagger when he gets to the concert site and gets off the helicopter, somebody cold cocks him in the face.
They hit Mick. Somebody hit him.
Yeah, some kid just comes up and just says, you know, hate you, Mick Jagger, and punches him. The whole day was just filled with random acts of violence. It was just a terrible, bad happenstance from the dawn when the gates crashed and the crowd flooded in, even the night before, which was some kind of like medieval bacchanal in the woods with, you know, thousands of stoned and drunk people wandering around in the dark, setting fires to barns and fences.
And the violence just escalates during the day, culminating in the Stones show. Set the stage here. Hell's Angels are starting to beat people with pool cues and brandishing weapons.
Well, one of the things that I wanted to point out in the book was the nature of the psychedelic drugs at that time. In 1967, the Summer of Love, the people who made LSD were missionaries. They were zealots, and the chemists took great lengths to make sure that the compounds were stable. 2 years later, the manufacturer just devolved, and there was a lot of really poisonous LSD out there. I talked to the doctors that ran the bummer tent, the psychiatrists, and they were appalled at what they were seeing. And the Hells Angels were all on drugs, those drugs too. There are a few guys that were put in front of a stage, 300,000 people from a mile away pressing down on the stage was 4 feet high. And right during the Santana set, the opening set of the day, mm-hmm. the pool cues came out and people in the audience started getting beaten.
And it's all on film in the famous documentary about the Stones, Gimme Shelter. The Stones are playing, and the Angels just keep beating people up, and both Mick Jagger and Keith Richards plead with the Angels to stop.
Who's fighting what for? Who's fighting and what for? Why are we fighting? Why are we fighting? We don't want to fight. Come on. Look, Pat, that guy there, if he doesn't stop it, man. Listen, either those cats call it, man, or we don't play.
There's a lot of blame to go around for Altamont, but you seem to put a lot of it in the book on Mick Jagger and his ego. You write, Jagger made the fatal error of believing his own hype. He bought into the myth of Woodstock and believed that he could do it better.
There was just so much innocence, and in the innocence, an arrogance. Nobody really knew what they were doing. They just assumed it could be done. And Jagger was dismissive of things that were brought up in planning sessions like sanitation and food and water. Oh, those are practical realities. We can deal with those later.
Right.
So I don't think they were really very conscious of this. I think they lived in a bubble and just felt they were the Rolling Stones, and of course this would just work out and be fine.
Well, you seem to imply, too, that they needed an ending for their movie, and boy, did they get it.
More than they planned on.
Yeah.
But the movie, of course, is embedded in all the story. They moved the concert at the last minute because of the movie and their unwillingness to negotiate any piece of the movie rights with the owners of Sears Point Raceway, where after the Golden Gate Park site had collapsed, they were moving this. And that place had parking for 100,000 cars and infrastructure. It had a site on the hill where the stage would be elevated above the crowd. It was much more suitable than some dumpy track in the middle of nowhere with no toilets and no water. And that's never part in the movie. The movie doesn't make it clear. There's scenes in the movie where they're negotiating with sheriffs and stuff, but it's not like made clear exactly what's going on. What's going on is the Stones are trying to save their money, and they don't care who they do business with as long as they keep 100% of the revenues from this movie.
You raised some questions in the book, too, of where were the police? They still had a responsibility here. The Hells Angels had control of the stage and the perimeter, and the police were largely absent until things got really out of control.
Oh, the police didn't show up until after there was a murder. There were no arrests made. They just sat there and watched it. The vehicular manslaughter case, which rarely gets mentioned, they had the suspect in custody, and he got away.
Joel, there's a popular idea that Altamont marked the end of 60s idealism. Is that accurate, or was this just a really dark day? What changed after Altamont?
I'm not sure what changed after Altamont. It certainly wasn't the end of the movement. It wasn't the end of idealism. It wasn't the end of even free concerts in the park. It left its mark on the people that were involved in it. I don't think the Stones or the Grateful Dead or even the Jefferson Airplane were ever the same again.
Neither were the Hells Angels, who kind of already seen as a public enemy, certainly were looked down on even also, more after Altamont.
Also true. It was really the beginning of the end for the Hells Angels.
Joel, for all the darkness and violence and ugliness of that day, the Stones played really well, yeah?
I heard a 16-track mix done by Bob Matthews, who was the engineer for the Grateful Dead, recorded that day. And you wouldn't believe how good the Stones sound. Charlie Watts on drums, Bill Wyman on bass have everything locked down. And Mick Taylor and Keith Richards' guitars are just like gears turning together. And Jagger singing like he really means it. None of that kind of caricature vocals that he sometimes lapses into. Very committed, very convincing.
The Hells Angels ruined a great concert.
The fear that was coursing through those guys, the adrenaline, obviously played such a role, and they just went and buried themselves in the music. That's what musicians do.
Joel Selvin's book is Altamont, The Rolling Stones, The Hells Angels, and the Inside Story of Rock's Darkest Day.